Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a great weekend or a great week, whatever time you're listening to this. Before we start the podcast, please hit subscribe. Please give us a review whenever you finish listening. It just keeps the podcast going, and I do really, really appreciate it. We're getting a lot of really good feedback from the podcast. So just thank you so much for listening. It just means the world to me. I started this podcast a couple years ago now. It seems to be growing, and I just love doing them. So thank you for all the support. It really, really means the world. Anyway, podcast time, and this week is the one and only Bontan. Bontan came out with a remix of Josh Butler called You Got a Feeling, and it blew up massively in the UK and Europe. Back, I don't fully know the dates. We talk about this in the podcast, so I'll leave that story for you guys. But over the years, I've become close with Bontan. I love his music. He's an insane producer, insane DJ, and also one of the nicest guys in the industry. I wanted to get him on, asked him, and he was down. So I'm gonna let you guys listen to this one. It's a long one. It's an hour and 50 minutes, but there's some absolute gems in there, and I just hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed it. So without further ado, one and only Bontan. Mr. Bontan, we got your internet working. Yep. What's cooking?
Finally got it working. That was hard work, wasn't
it? How much do you feel like an old man when you just can't work out technology now?
Do you know what's funny? The go-to thing is just turn it on and off again. Like, that's exactly what my dad would say, and that's literally what we just did.
Oh, it's awful. We're literally turning into our parents.
Slowly but surely, yeah, we are. Literally ran to the router, switch off quick. No, but we're watching, my kid's watching Teletubbies in the other room. So it's like, no, we can't, Teletubbies is on.
So good. How are you, man, anyway?
Yeah, good. Fresh, feel good. I've had a couple of weeks off because second baby's due like in the next couple of days, few days. So just going to stay at home and just, wait till we've got to go to the hospital, basically, yeah.
So when this podcast comes out, you're going to have a new baby.
Pretty much guaranteed.
Congrats. How's dad life? Man.
It's tough, and it's the best thing ever. It's fun. Like, it's like 85% fun. Yeah. The rest is stress and anxiety trying to keep something alive. And then the other bit of it is like just being away on the road is tough because you're just on FaceTime for twice a day, and yeah, then that's it. It sucks. But then it's good when you get home and then he doesn't forget who you are. That's always nice.
Yeah, I guess so. Do you change your touring schedule, or have you like just stayed the same where you're just like non-stop
just tried to keep it. I mean, I'm not doing any shows in December up until the end. I'm going to have like five weeks just at home, just that's it. And then I'm going to do Warehouse Project and then London at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And then back on tour in America in January.
Sick.
So it's just trying to find the balance. I'm not doing as much as I used to in terms of, say, you've got like five down days in America.
Yeah.
I try not to stay there for them or try and come home. Whereas that 3 years ago, I'd just stay in LA for 5 days or something and just run around LA being an idiot. Whereas now I'm just like, if I can get home for 5 days, I'm going straight home. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's the thing, isn't it? I was talking to Eli Brown about it, and obviously he's got kids as well. And he does exactly the same now. It's like you fly to America for the weekend and then fly back. And then even if you have to go home for the next week, go back to America for the next weekend, it's like, what you got to do?
I did it because I knew I was having this time off in October. I literally flew to Australia for 2 weeks, came home, and then went straight to America, back and then back again, and then back. And I was just like, got home at like at the start of November, and I was just like, I need this break. You've done it, you've probably done it yourself a million times. You just don't have a body clock in the end.
Yeah.
You just like kind of just in autopilot, just waking up whenever your alarm goes off in a hotel.
And I think
just,
also you've got a little one as well. So it's like all priorities go out the window for you. It just turns into the little one. And then
exactly. Yeah.
Like you can't be selfish when you've got a little one at all.
This is what I realized is how selfish I used to be.
Yeah.
It literally was like, whatever. Like I was, me being priorities is completely gone now. It doesn't bother as long as I can actually, I'm grateful enough to be able to work and tour.
Yeah.
Like for the sole reason as I can provide my kids. No, that's literally, it's gone from me being able to be like what's on the hit list for the next gig? I'm working a play, which is like my favorite, like right off the checklist of like bucket list gigs. Now it's like, right, I have to get do this gig, provide for the kids and go. That's what it's become.
It's really nice, realistically. Like, it scares the shit out of me, if I'm honest with you, coming from somebody
terrifying.
That's like single and doesn't have kids. But I think it's so nice to hear as well, is like how it seems to be coming up a lot on the podcast, how artists, well, we're all getting older, right? And we're all going through that stage of kids are getting involved in our lives. And even if it's not, like for me, it's I don't have kids, but I have like five niece and nephews, and it's like you kind of see the priorities change in your life, where you start as an artist trying to become the biggest artist in the world and take over the world, and then these little fuckers come involved, and it's like I got to do everything for them now.
You're trying to be the next big artist. No, you're trying to be the next greatest dad. That's it now.
Literally.
That's the goal.
How did
even with nieces and nephews, it was, I had one niece and it was like, I was treating her like, I'm like my little best mate. You know what I mean? It's like, so even going from a niece to a parent, the good thing about having like nieces and nephews, you can give them back when
100%.
you're just like, I'm done with that now. Or is this one you can't?
The minute they start crying, it's like, you can have my back. I'm out. It's
different now. When they start crying, they look for you and you're like,
What do I do?
You just got to learn on the fly. That's what I did. I just learned on the fly. What I've learned, the way this thing is, I catch myself speaking in like kid voice to a kid. I'm that dad now that's like doing out voices and trying to be like the jester in the house on the hands and knees pretending to be a lion and stuff. And I'm like, I've got a deadline to finish on this remix.
Who would have thought it, man? Who would have thought
it? I know.
It's crazy. It's crazy how life... I don't know about you, but when did you have your first one?
So he's 19 months. So
during COVID, right?
Yeah, peak. Yeah.
So it's like... Do you think it was kids always on the card for you?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I've been with he's been running for a shot now. You can hear him. Always on the cards, yeah.
Yeah.
It was always, because I've been with Steph for years.
Yeah.
Years and years. And we've been married for a long time as well. So what do you want? What are you after?
Love it.
This is my life.
Love it.
How's... Wait, 2 seconds, mate.
No worries. Do you think, man?
Sad life. What's it do? Say hi.
Hi.
That's how most studio sessions go as well.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah. Because he knows what goes on in the studio.
Yeah.
So he'll run up and run into the room and just go nuts in the studio.
That's so good.
Yeah. I've got him on drum machine. He's pretty sick on a drum machine already.
Do you reckon you're going to turn him into DJ?
Yeah, absolutely.
100%, well, isn't it?
Do you know what it's like? I just want to give him options, you know?
Yeah.
Because when I was in school, it was like, it's probably the same for you. You've got certain career paths, certain jobs, and there was no such thing as being involved in the arts in my school anyway.
Yeah.
Failed music. I started DJing in school. So I got my first set of decks when I was 15.
Yeah.
And I got ripped to fuck in school. Like, nailed. It was like, he thinks he's going to be a DJ. It wasn't cool to be a DJ.
No.
Like, going to buy vinyls at, like, HMV and stuff. And I'm like, doing shit like that. It's like, it wasn't a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
And then all of, like, now it's the coolest thing to do.
It's the thing to do. In school,
it's like, yeah, it's the thing to do. So he'll probably grow up thinking this is a really cool job. And I was just like, it wasn't when we were growing up and we were in school. So I just want to give him options. Like, obviously, it'll shift again. And when he gets to 15, 16, there'll be something else that's cool or he wants to do. But I'm not going to try and throw him to school and be like, right, you've got to follow the curriculum and you've got to, because I failed school miserably and I left when I was 16 and started DJing when I was 17.
Yeah.
So it's like, you don't have to go and follow the rules in school. Well,
I think it's such a shame because I had that with my music teacher in school. He was like, electronic music's not a genre and you're not going to have a career in music. Literally, he said that to me. And I'm like, fuck you. Like,
they asked you to go back in?
Not yet. But they did, but he wasn't working. I kind of wanted him to be there.
Just be so you could just go and go, I didn't learn anything.
Yeah. But it's like, why do you think people do that? Where like teachers kind of just crush kids' dreams when it should be completely the opposite?
This is going to be a massive generalization because they probably have theirs crushed as well.
Yeah.
Like, if this is going to sound really shitty, but it's not. This is coming from my pea-sized brain trying to make sense of why my teachers were just like horrible to me. It's like, you've got a music teacher there who isn't involved in music.
Yeah.
So that must be like a painter not being able to paint or something. Do you know what I'm saying? He's like, he's not performing, or he's not doing what he's having to teach kids that 99% of the class don't want to learn.
Yeah.
And it was his passion back when he was growing up, was to be involved in music. And he's trying to teach it to these kids that don't want to learn it. I'm guessing that's probably why, for most, you know, lessons and stuff.
And they're usually very good musicians.
Oh, he's incredible. Yeah. I caught him a few times just playing piano before the lesson starts. And I was just sat there just like,
yeah,
this is insane. But it's just about catching a certain break at a certain time. And 99% of the time, people just don't get that break.
Is it about not getting the break, or is it not actually working hard enough, or just giving it enough time? Because I know you, before you were Bontan, you were somebody else, right? You were your own name.
Yeah, I've been making music since I was 15.
Yeah, so 14. I remember I initially met you as you were under your real name.
Yeah, which, like, was a long time ago.
Years ago.
Was it Amsterdam?
I don't actually know if we met in person, but we were speaking online on Facebook. Facebook Messenger.
Yeah.
But this was you were down as Andrew Phillips and
MSN.
Yeah. And that's when I first started talking to you. And then Bontan was a new project and kind of kicked off pretty quickly for you, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't really know what I was doing when I first started out making music, and it was all awful as well.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't know how to make music or how to arrange records. I went into it so naively and just didn't do any research about how records are made. It was kind of just like, just throw it, which is how everyone's.
But YouTube, there wasn't YouTube back then.
No, it was a Future Music magazine.
Yeah, exactly.
DVDs at the front. Yeah. That was literally it. Future Music magazine. And then just like meeting other people, like that would had studios. You could go and sit with them for half an hour, and then picking up a little dashboard logic, and then just thought, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And I remember someone said to me, just treat it like a PlayStation, like an Xbox. There's no wrong answers. You're not going to break the thing if you press the wrong button. If you go into the audio settings and you fuck them up like we've done. But like,
no, just turn it off and turn it on, mate.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. Don't save. Turn it on and off again. But there's no really wrong. That's why I went into it.
Yeah.
And then I sort of like dipped out for a year or two just so I could just figure out what music I wanted to make and how I wanted to sort of like progress with my sound. And then my first remix was the remix for Josh.
Yeah.
That was like the first track I did under Bontan. And I was just like, well, shit, I'm getting paid to go and play somewhere. And it was insane. I started like just doing like London, Manchester, Dublin, like Glasgow was all, I played Glasgow like 6 times a year.
Wow.
Only for like a few hundred quid, but I was like, that's insane for me. Getting like 300 quid a gig and like being able to go to Dublin for the weekend. This is ace, man. I was like, this is, if I die now, I'm happy.
How many years ago was that? Because that was a
Bontan's 10 years next year.
That's mad. Is that how long the remix is? How old the remix is?
2013, that came out,
Damn.
It's wild, isn't it?
I remember when it came out. It was the biggest. This is what I wanted to talk to you about a lot, because I think not everyone, but a lot of artists, especially new artists coming up, trying to make hit records and trying to write records that sound like others, or just because it's so easy nowadays to see the payoff of a big record, right?
Sure.
Because it's social media and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually becoming more and more common now that people have a hit record as their first record, or maybe like their second or third record. It's still very rare though. But your first record was the remix of Josh, and it was the biggest record of the year, maybe of the 2 years, really. How, as an artist, do you deal with that? Like, when it happens, and then after it happens, and then the years after it's happened?
It didn't really blow up instantly, that record.
Mm-hmm.
It took about... So we released it, and then it took about two or three months to get to the Beatport top 10.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know how it is now on Beatport. If your track's not in there in the top 10 within 4 days, you know it's not getting in there. And if it does, it's very rare. It grows.
Yeah.
And then the lifespan of a record these days is probably about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And this took about 3 months to get into Beatport.
Well, there was only... let's kind of paint the situation to everybody that's like a bit younger in the industry. Like, Beatport was the one. There was like
the only one. Yeah,
there was nowhere else to. There was
no Spotify.
No app. Maybe there was iTunes then. Maybe
iTunes was about
But like in dance music,
just iTunes was just starting. But iTunes was such a mess to use 10 years ago. It was a pain.
Yeah,
no one wanted to use iTunes, and people who went to events and like people who were involved, like not DJs, they would buy off Beatport as well, which was because it was the only place to get like dance music records. You couldn't just go and listen to Spotify, find your favorite artist and see what they've released. And it's
was there YouTube?
You have to go to Beatport.
Was there YouTube? It was YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube was about, yeah.
What? But were people releasing music on YouTube then? Like,
I think it was mainly like Subsoul would do.
Oh yeah, that was it.
Stuff like that, you know. It was more platform. There was like a handful of platforms that had decent reach. And then if you like, they still do it now. What's that one? I can't remember the name for life. There's a few of them now that like they've got a bunch of listeners. You know, good music going to be released there. And people try and get their records on there instead of their own channels because it's going to get listened to more.
What year was this?
2013.
Yeah. Yeah, YouTube came out in 2005. Wow.
Was YouTube about in 2013?
So I guess like it took a while to go into the Beatport, but I think that's
3 months. Yeah. But, and then it was like number 10. And then the week later it was like 9, 8. And I was like, so we got to Deep House number one and it wasn't going to the overall for ages. And I just said to Josh, we've got John Red number one off like both of one of our first releases in Win, mate. Let's go. And then it just kept creeping and creeping. And what were we up against? I think we were up against Martin Garrix, Animals or something like that.
Wow.
It was something like that. And then it just went to number one. It stayed there for months, like literally months. And it's like the second highest selling track on Beatport ever, I think it is.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's wild. What's the first? Do you know what the first is? Got to be Camel
I think
Fat.
It's Cola. Yeah, it's Cola.
Yeah, it's got to be Camel Fat.
Cola, yeah. It's Cola because they were number one. I think they're still in the house top 100 still.
Are they really? Damn.
Yeah. So that was... but then going from... I was still doing like local... When that was out and that was number one, I was still doing local... I remember Stephen Gerrard came in... While I was DJing, Stephen Gerrard came into the bar with his wife and he sat at the end of the bar. And Alex came over to the DJ box and she went, have you got that Josh Butler remix? And she said it to me and I was just like the local DJ in the bar. And I was like, oh shit, if only you knew. And she was like, you got that Josh Butler remix? I've got a feeling. And I was just like, yeah, I'll play it for you if you want. She was like, yeah. And I was like, that's me, you know. And she was like, what? And then she was like, what? What are you on about? And I was just like, it was so loud. I had the booth monitors cranked up. And she was like, what's you? And I must just sound like such a prick. And I was just like, yeah, don't worry about it. I'll play it next. And then I played it. And then Stephen Gerrard and his wife cop started dancing to like the only record they danced to all night. And I was like, win.
No way. For any American.
Was, like, even then, I was still just DJing around bars, DJ like 4 times a week, just in a small town. And then the local gigs, the Regi Bangers started to come in, like the London's, Bristol's. And then it went from like 300 quid a gig to like pay a 500 to come to Ministry of Sound. And I was like, fuck, yes.
Yeah.
I can take the week off doing my local gigs to go and do that one gig in London. And then got to the point where it was like a request every week. And I hated letting people down, you know, in the local bars because I just hated letting people down. Yeah. And I had to say to him, look, I'm going to have to give this a full go, being my full-time job.
Yeah.
Because I always used to think to myself, how are they transitioning to being like just a local DJ into like a local resident of like 4 residencies to then touring? What's it going to be? Because I always thought I was crap at making music.
Yeah.
So I always thought I was a pretty good DJ, but I always thought I was pretty shit at making tunes. So when that came out, even when I was playing it, I was like, oh, the mixdown sounds awful. Like, I'm not happy with this. And then I saw a few DJs online playing it at Miami. And I was like, well, it must be all right if they're playing it.
Yeah.
And then this is no word of a lie. Only the past sort of 6 months I've been happy with my own mixdowns.
Really?
I swear, yeah. And I've had like a few Beatport number ones now. And I'm still, even to this day, I'm just like, it's only been the past 6 months that I'm like, I'm actually happy with it now.
Yeah.
Not having to send it to 100 DJs and like mix engineers and being like, can you listen to this for me? Where am I going wrong? Da-da-da. I'm like at this point now, like I know sonically how everything should sound.
Have you
it
ever?
Takes years, you know yourself, it takes years, to learn how to mix down properly. There's no way to learn apart from just doing it and making shit records.
Well, that's the thing. It takes years to actually learn how to make good records.
Yeah, true.
And it's like there's so much luck involved in it as well, because it's like, oh, you found a sample or you pressed a button on a keyboard or whatever. Yeah. Like, just fucking luck. Like, it's just like, you just did it and it worked. But I want to go back to the original kind of what we started talking about and how your first record turned into making your career a full-time career and kind of the, like, the pros and the cons and the pressures and the not pressures of that, and kind of how you kind of worked that as throughout, because back then, so now if that record came out and it did what it did, it would probably be, well, it was everywhere anyway, but it would probably be a fast thing, right? So it's like, let's say for instance, like the new Shaq record on Trick, I don't know if you've heard it, but it's like, blows the fuck up all over social media. And you become instantly a huge kind of ticket seller in a certain market, right?
Yeah.
When your remix came out, like, what was the process? So it took like a few weeks to kind of get into Beatport. Beatport was what every promoter, every artist, every manager.
All you can do is compare it to Spotify the numbers. You know, a few millions of streams is probably like getting overall Beatport number one.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially when it stays there as well.
Yeah. So how did that change your career? How did that move forward to like getting booked even more so? So you get booked in Ministry of Sound for 500 quid. Like, then when does it really start taking off? Or was it not? Or was it something that it was just like, okay, this record's doing really well and everyone's playing it, and then I just slowly, my career slowly grows and grows and grows? Like, I don't know. I knew you back then, but I didn't know you that well.
I just thought what I was doing was, I never thought I could tour outside of the UK.
Yeah.
Because it was a very much a UK sound at the time, where even though it's, I didn't realize it, recently, if I go to like South America, people ask for that record and I'm like, shit, they were into it here.
Yeah.
Like, there was a market here. Do you know what I mean? Or there was a market in America. And like, if I go to certain places where it's my first time there, the tour videos will always be that record. Not always, but most of the time is that record.
Yeah.
I'm like, fuck, people actually did hear it. So I thought this is the only places I could tour. So at first I was like, just follow it up if you can. Mm. And then I released Move On Out, which was, I think it was Deep House number one or two. I can't remember. That was like 4 months later.
Yeah.
So everyone's like, shit, he's red hot. He's going to keep releasing his bangers.
Yeah.
But then for me, that sound was like, you know how that sound came and sort of went, sort of Deep House sound. I instantly then stopped making it and tried to move forward.
Yeah.
Even though I was getting booked around the UK for these gigs that I was known for that record for. Mm. Progressing to the next stage of career, just going back to that point, you've got to sort of like, it's not necessarily just the music that you're releasing, you've got to back it up with the gigs as well. So if you turn up and like just clear the crowd or don't know how to read the crowd and just play, just don't play to what people want to hear. I feel like you've got to do that when you first start out. You can't just go in there. I mean, some people can, but I didn't feel like I could go in there and just completely express myself and play what I wanted.
Totally.
I was shitting myself. Like, yeah. I've got to get a return booking here because I've just left all my residencies.
Yeah.
So I've got to make sure every single, if I got one negative comment, it would absolutely ruin me for like a week. Yeah. That's all I'd think about.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, fuck, I need to just go in there. I'm those proper people pleaser, like play to the room and make sure every single person that leaves that room has had the time of their life. And then most of the time, because I DJed for a long time around bars, I could read the room pretty well.
Yeah.
If I needed to get off a record instantly, I just bite the bullet and just mix it straight away.
Yeah.
To make sure people leave happy. And then it's sort of like getting a return booking and then throw an extra couple of hundred quid on it and then moving, just keep, I was battering the same markets for like 2-3 years.
Mm.
It was always Dublin. It was always Scotland. The 2 or 3 London gigs, a couple of Manchesters. It was always at Bristol, Nottingham as well. So I just keep going around those markets for like 2-3 years. And then I'd already stopped making that sound. I was trying to find like what I wanted to do next, because if I, with me musically, if I don't feel like I'm moving forward, I'm going backwards. Mm. So I'm not just going to sit there and just keep making the same sound before it dies out and then switch.
Yeah.
I always want to be one step ahead and try and make something fresh. And when did my first international booking come in? Like a big international. It was sort of like you go to ADE, and then I think the first one was Dubai. Because the longest flight I'd ever done was to Amsterdam.
That's an interesting first international, Dubai.
Yeah, I think it was Dubai. And then saying that, I didn't actually go. I got the booking and didn't go because I used to be terrified of flying.
Oh, really?
Awful. I used to take 3 Valium just to fly to Dublin.
Wow.
It was awful. Yeah, so I got the booking for Dubai. That was the first booking. I didn't go. I got to the airport and just went, fuck this, and just went home. That was in 2014, 15, something like that. That was the first international. And then it was just like Amsterdam. You reach out to there, you do the AD parties, and you go back to Ireland and do all them. And then I just sort of, something switched when I released on Hot Creations in 2017. So from 2013 to 2017, I was just strictly UK. Like, I literally didn't get anything else out of the UK. Yeah. And then I released on Hot Creations 2017, and it just cracked the market for me.
Really?
Globally. Yeah, because I feel like, let me just figure out 17. So release a track mid 2000. So Call You Back came out with Josh. Yeah. That was that overall number one then as well.
Was that on Defect? Was that Defected?
That was on Josh's label, Origins.
Okay.
So we released that in 2017 in May, and that was overall number one for, that did like a month overall.
Mm, wow.
And that was, I thought that was pretty good in 2017, yeah, considering how quickly records move. And then 2 months later, I had the Hot Creations EP, and then I had my first tour in Australia, and then my first tour in America, literally the end of 2017.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jesus Christ. I thought touring was like fun in the UK. And then it just cracked me open wide to like a global market. And then since then, it's just going to new territories. And the year after that, I went to Tokyo. And then the year after that, I've just done pretty much everywhere now. Mm.
It's such an amazing
feeling. That was the sort of timeline for me. It was,
because I thought like, from an outsider and like not being like really tight with you until like the last few years, but like I thought like Got a Feeling came out and it was like explosion.
Yeah, it definitely was, but only in the UK.
Yeah,
I didn't get anything outside of the UK until 2017.
The UK market's so weird. It's so strange how like it's so insular. Like, England adopted the rave, right? We kind of adopted electronic music,
yeah,
and just kept it there.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't. People look at it so. People look at like, look at the UK as like almost like the home of electronic dance music in certain ways.
Yeah, for sure.
But it doesn't, like, a record that does really well in the UK doesn't necessarily, like, now I'm talking nowadays, doesn't necessarily do really well anywhere else.
Yeah, that's true. But the thing is, it was, because...
But it was for you back then.
But even though I wasn't getting booked out of there, though. So it's weird, because it was kind of like, people love that record globally. But it's like, so this guy's had one remix and that's it. There's no back catalogue, because it's my first ever thing. So it's like, are they going to take a punt on bringing me to Chile, to Santiago, or to Australia? Even though it was the second biggest market, was in Australia.
Was it really? Wow.
That record, yeah, because it went on to, I think it got on like Abercrombie and Fitch adverts out there.
No way.
Yeah, so I think that's the reason why it got huge out there. But I wasn't getting bookings out there because of that record. So I was kind of like, I understand why I wasn't getting the bookings outside of the UK, because people have obviously heard it, but there's nothing to, like, Josh was going touring. Because Josh had a few records before that one.
Mm.
And I was thinking, oh, Josh is getting booked through all these places. And I'm like, I don't understand why I'm not, but I do now, because I had one, that was my only thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to go over there and play one record. They don't probably didn't trust me to go over there and take a gamble on me, because God knows what else I was going to play in their eyes. You know what I mean? So now it's like I've got a decent back catalogue and I can kind of tour in most markets.
Yeah, so it's really interesting when you say, like, the association with Hot Creations. Obviously, during that time, Hot Creations is still a huge record label now. But it's, back then, it was like on another level.
One release could just explode, blow you up on Hot Creations. And that's what it did for me.
Yeah.
I don't think if I didn't release on Hot Creations in 2017, I don't believe I'd be touring globally.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'd like to think I would, because I've had heaps of music since then that's been successful. But in terms of like figures, you can see it yourself when you look at streaming platforms.
Yeah.
That's nearly as many as Got a Feeling.
Yeah.
So that sort of cracked me open wide. And if you got a release on Hot Creations through those sort of like 15, 16, 17, 18 sort of years, you were set. You could tour off that one release for like a year.
Yeah, Hot Creations was very powerful worldwide. Very massive.
It's, like you said, it still is, but I think it was just a different level then.
I think I'd like to get your opinion on this, but like, I don't think labels have the power that they do than they did. I think that for me personally, the only label that I that I see that still has the power that, and I mean the power to, you release a record and you're touring worldwide straight after.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the record doesn't do that well, and I think that's Afterlife.
I was going to say Afterlife. It's, I think they've got that market sewn up though.
It's,
so that's probably why.
Why? What do you think it is that Afterlife's,
I don't know,
done that nobody else has?
I just
doing?
Think they've just got such solid core fans, but that many of them that are like just so obsessed with the label.
Yeah.
That if they get a new artist on there, it's like they're cracked open wide to that entire fan base. And Afterlife is such a huge label.
Yeah.
And I love the music that comes out on Afterlife. Mm. I'm a fan as well. And I've done it myself. If a new artist gets released on there, I'll go and dig a little, go on Beatport and figure out, look at the back catalogue as well. And I just think they've got just diehard fans. Mm. That's what it is. And I think there's not, obviously there is other labels doing that sound, but they're the biggest. So if you're into that sound and you're into that label, you're going to be into the next big artist. And then you've got fans off the bat then.
I think Anjuna Deep does really well as well.
Yeah, I agree. And that their market as well, they've got theirs sewn up.
Yeah.
In terms of like the housey side though, and like...
It just isn't.
There isn't.
But I think this is my theory, and I came up with this weekend, having breakfast with a bunch of mates, and trance fans are like the most dedicated fans in the world. Okay? Yeah. So you'll go to a trance rave, and there'll literally be 50-year-olds in there still like... wanting to hear like Adagio for Strings because that's sick. What they love. And this is, people are going to hate me for saying this, Anjuna Deep and Tale of Us is very trancey.
Mm-hmm. It's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing, but I think people hate talking about, they don't like being associated with trance because trance is old and boring now. It's like... It's,
trance is sick.
I love trance, but it's like...
Yeah.
I think there's like...
It's kind of a slower, sort of slower, bit more...
Slow trance.
I was going to say. Yeah. It's cool.
It's cool, like, quotes, cool trance for me.
I don't think the sounds are as harsh, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The sound of kind of like... It's like the cutoff's just been pulled down a little bit. that's what it feels like.
But I think that's my theory, is that they've created this kind of... It's very emotional music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it people can relate to it a lot, and it's not super hard, which then attracts to a lot more of a broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
And they just love it, and their branding is so on point. And
I wish there was one label that would sort of like could break and act, but because there's that many labels now. Across entire genres that, you know, like the house and tech house or whatever you want to call it, sort of like this side of things, there's that many labels doing very similar things. I don't think there is, it's going to be a long time before there's one that really stands out and can, you know, premiere one artist that can then tour for a year or two
after the rest of it. Yeah, I think
a lot of artists are just set up their own labels, which is kind of the way. If you want to release music on your own terms and when you want to do it, you take all the royalties. And if you've got a similar sort of level of following as the label you're trying to release on anyway, just set up your own label.
I agree. I think it's also allows you to release when you want and what you want.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Not being in a waiting sort of like, you've got a track, right? This can't come out for 8 months.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't even know if I'm going to like it in 8 months. Never mind, like, want to release it.
Yeah. And it's also like realistically, we write a lot of music. I want to release a lot of music. My whole game plan now is like kind of switched to how it used to be, like where I used to release like a few records a year. Now, like next year, I'm releasing one every month and maybe a remix in between. And I think just the way... The length, well, what you were saying with You Got Feeling, like it took a month to get big, and then it took 3 months to become huge, and then it took 6 months to be the biggest thing in the world, and then it still was going a year later. Like records don't do that so much anymore, unless maybe one every 5 years. But I think the more music we put out, we're musicians. Like why would we not want to put music out? The whole point of
I think the Holding Back records is kind of like, in the hope that every single one does get the life and the length and it pops like you want it to. Whereas like if you release a record and if people have stopped talking about it within 2 weeks, you're like, shit, I've got 2 months before the next one comes
exactly.
out. And it's like, fuck. I mean, it's that's the beauty of like making music. You want to put out your best stuff that you truly believe will be around for ages. So that's sort of like the naivety in a nice way that you've got that much faith in that record that you don't want to release anything for the next 2 months because yeah. this is going to be here for 3 months. And then 2 weeks later, it's fucking 86 in genre on Beatport. So you're like, fuck, 6,000 streams. Yay.
Do you still look at Beatport though?
Nah, not anymore.
Yeah.
I'll look at Beatport in terms of where, like the first sort of like few days, if I get a banner or, because I'll always like, tweet or like yeah. Instagram thanks people for the support or whatever. But in terms of charts, I don't really look at the charts anymore.
How do you measure your success of a record?
I want to say Spotify, but then I don't really look at Spotify either. That'd be a lie. If I would say I was on Spotify checking the streams every day, I don't. Mm. It's more interaction on social media.
Yeah.
How many people are commenting on the videos, how many people are sending me DMs saying they love the record.
Yeah.
How many times I've been tagged in someone's story. Mainly that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Then you get, obviously, you look at radio, see what Radio 1 plays. You've got in for the release weekend. And as every other DJ does, you'll get the message the night before if you're going to be on Danny or Pete's show or whatever.
Yeah. Such a good feeling.
And then, it's ace, man.
It's weird, like, right?
Pete Tong or Danny to, like, introduce your record. It's funny because I've known Danny for, like, a long, when he was at uni.
Yeah.
He was at uni. That was, like, over from my house. Mm. So I knew him when he was just, he used to play in goal for the uni team. And he used to come to, like, where I used to play and we used to hang out together. And then he said, I'm going to do this Radio 1 thing. This when he won the competition.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was just like, mate, no way, this is sick. And then I'd be like in the kitchen, I had the radio on and he'd listen to him doing like his competition.
Yeah.
And then he wins it and it's like the highest listened to show now on Radio 1.
For, is like, it really?
Dance music. I think it's the highest for dance music.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's mad.
And I was just like, fuck, man, I was like so happy for him. The thing is that Danny hasn't changed either. It's just a sound slab.
Yeah. Yeah, he's super nice dude.
Yeah, so top guy, man.
It's mad how that era of radio was so powerful as well when that happened.
Like, oh my God. Like again, a Radio 1 play could like, you get your booking off the back of a few Radio 1 plays as well.
Whereas it's nothing.
I don't think it's as strong anymore. I honestly couldn't tell you what the formula is to getting that sort of pop. Like it's having a good record, but it's then having good social media at the same time.
It's everything. I think it's like, honestly, from what
it's just a storm, of a bunch of stuff coming together at once.
Magnitude of everything. So it's like, for me, what I think is like very strong record. It gets played on radio a lot. It gets streamed a lot. So it gets put in all the playlists and your social media marketing behind it is just on another level.
Yeah.
And then you've also got to have the DJs playing it as well.
Yeah, DJ support's massive because you've got content of some of your peers playing your records. That's huge in terms of like getting their fans to be then your fans. And a lot of people hate on social media and having like the word content, but it's like that's just part of the new part of the job.
Yeah,
it's just something new that people just don't want to adapt to. Like I admit I'm terrible at it.
Yeah,
I am, but I'm not going to complain about it. Mm. That is part and parcel of like being an artist. Now you've got to back it up with your socials as well.
I think I totally agree with you. I think social media is the reason why we're all still doing what we're doing and kind of don't have to have day jobs, to be fair, because it's allowed it to be way more commercialized. Which means that there's way more money to it, and which means that we can all earn more and more money doing it. So yeah, it's great. I have an issue with the social media companies just choking all of your fucking traffic to you.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
That's the thing. Yeah, it's
stopping your reach, so you have to pay. That's literally what it is.
And also, like when you do pay, all of your organic reach goes because they expect you're going to pay anyway. So it's
keep paying.
It's just
the worst when you get like you do a post and you go into reach and it's like 600 people and you're like, how?
Yeah,
how? What? Why? Why click follow on someone if you can't see the shit?
Yeah.
What's the point?
It's pointless.
It's so. It's weird. It's a weird. I just wonder. Obviously, TikTok's blowing up now as well. I just wonder what the next sort of like. Because for me, Instagram is dying a death.
Yeah, my Instagram does okay, but again, it's like classic example. Like, I don't know. It makes sense. To be fair, it makes sense. You put a video up or you put a picture up of you like being a goofball and it does crazy well, right?
Yeah.
And then you like put a video up of like, here's my next single, and then click through to the links, and then it's like fucking six clicks, and you're like, what? But again, this goes back to our conversation of music, putting music out, and how to promote records nowadays. I'd really be interested to see your thoughts on this or how you kind of plan to do it. But let's say, for instance, I did a remix of Depeche Mode and a lot of people were playing it during the summer and it kind of did really well. We like put it out on Beatport for a week and then took it down. The minute, like, I was asked about that record multiple times every single day. And it was kind of did its thing. We put it out and like literally within 2 days it went techno number one on Beatport, because we only put it on Beatport.
Yeah.
And we had a fuck ton of click throughs from social media. I was like, this is really interesting. You then put a new single out that nobody knows about, that you've only been playing for like a month in your sets and no one else really has it. And no one else is really playing it. And no one's really fucking interested when you put it out.
So you're saying the new single is in completely original material as well?
Yeah.
I mean, listen to, you know yourself, listen to how many records you get now where it's a regurgitated sample of something. Mm. Across the board in every genre.
Yeah.
I think it's the easiest way to get sort of like eyes on you quickly. If you're just starting out, is to sort of like release something with a big sample. And just like, I've noticed that a lot recently.
Yeah.
You go to, just going around Ibiza a few times this summer and just listen to like people play. You knew 70% of the DJ sets because of the samples that were throughout the DJ set, which is mad because I don't know where this sort of like thing has come from. In terms of like, it's got to have a big sample, but a sample that people have already heard. Like, that's what you need now. Or it's resung, or I don't know. In terms of like completely original, this is generalization again, but there's millions of records, not millions, but there's a bunch of records coming out where it is original and you've got to just dig harder to find them. Mm. But then you play them and people are like, what's, and I feel like this is just a kind of like impatient sort of crowds.
Yeah.
Sort of generation of like,
that's it.
People that are going out, I think it's just.
But is it the crowds?
DJ's hand.
Is it the crowds or is it the DJs? I think
they're both sort of chasing each other. Yeah. So like, the crowds are getting more impatient. So a DJ make a record to then sample it there, and then the crowds would want that record, which makes them more impatient. They're waiting for that. Then they play that, and then the DJ's like, "Shit, I need more." So they make more of them, and then it's just kind of like a ladder. It's sort of just like spiraling.
Because we all sample. That's the whole point of house music, right? Sampling is house music. But for me, like, sampling was about finding interesting samples and kind of
just gems,
and creating your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you like sample like Britney Spears or Black Eyed Peas or something that was a number one globally, like for me, there's just something about that that just. It's like you're not actually.
It's already successful. It's just kind of like a get out of jail free cards for a DJ set. Depending on where you're playing, obviously, it's just I'm gonna sound like such an old man, like complaining about this.
I think it's actually really interesting because I don't think there's anything. I personally don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's not what I want to do. It's not as a producer, artist, whatever you want to call. It's not what I want to do. One of my biggest records is Hallelujah, which is a Candy Stanton sample. Like, but people don't know the original of they know the Lars one that came out and defected.
Yeah.
But that wasn't that successful. That was probably successful in the 60s, but it wasn't successful like, or in the 80s. It wasn't successful as like a commercial like hit, like pop record. And so I think, like, I can't really talk shit on people sampling big records because I've done it myself.
Yeah.
But I think for me that I'm finding now is that it's the samples that they're using are all like, they're bootlegs. Obvious. They're bootlegs.
Yeah.
And it's what,
That's what it would be known as 10 years
ago. Yeah, exactly. And like white labels and all of that. Yeah. It's like,
the thing is, it's like, I'm not going to moan about it because it's popular for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's popular. That's what pop is. It's popular. It's, people want to listen to that. So, like, I can't hate on it because there's thousands of people that want to go out to the rave at the weekend and listen to those records. So, like, why shouldn't they get what they want to listen to? Maybe it's just, again, it's not for me, but I'm not going to bash it. It's just the way it's gone over the past few years. I don't think COVID's helped. I think people came out of, like, I don't want to talk about COVID, but like people came out of that sort of like time gone, shit, what do we play?
Yeah.
What's a hot, like what's good, what's hot new music? And it was kind of like everyone just sort of panicked at the same time and thought, shit, let's just play something that people know.
Yeah.
I was probably guilty of that myself a few times when it first started as well. It came back out of the pandemic. And then people just started making these like bootlegs, and then it's just completely blown. And that is just that in terms of globally market, that is a huge market people want to listen to.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's a commercial market, very commercial market it's like that I don't think we've seen before. And I think that is because of social media, because of TikTok, because of Instagram, and because I think a lot of these DJs aren't just DJs now, they're celebrities, and they have such big followings. And when you have like hundreds of thousands of followers on your social media, like, you're popular, you're commercial. Like, you're not there's nothing underground about having a million followers. Like, it's cool. I think it's fucking cool having a million followers.
Yeah,
but it's like it's not underground at all. So you have, I feel like there comes a point where, like, especially as a DJ, it's not like you're Beyonce where you're like making music to just make great music. I think as a DJ, you're a service to your fans to a certain extent. Mm. And, but then the other night I was listening to Bonobo's new album, or newish album, the one that he's just been nominated for a Grammy for. And whilst I was listening to that, it kind of like went through to all of his old albums. And I'm like, this guy's making, not sampling at all, all original vocals, all original music. And it's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And I think this is the thing that I kind of realized when I was listening. I was like, I'm just so caught in the DJ bubble where we only see how we release music and how our peers release music, and that there's not really much of a lifetime through each record because of we're in that fast paced releasing thing. But then there is scope, and I just feel like I'm not too sure how we can change that.
That's the goal, though, right? Is to become that sort of artist.
Yeah.
But then it's tough when we're on sort of like big lineups and it's like no one's there specifically just to see you. So you want to kind of make it, get those sort of like pops at your DJ set.
Mm.
And it's like, it's hard to release music that is so original and so fresh without sort of leaning into a certain direction with it. Obviously, we want to, but like you said, we're in a DJ bubble, so we see what we want to see and what we think is going to sort of keep our careers alive.
Yeah.
But then you see people like, say, like Bonobo, just completely original and completely unapologetic, just doing his thing, and it's like, fuck, I want to do that.
I'm more moving towards that route, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Like, I'm more at the point where I love the whole DJ thing is the fucking best, right? And it's what, but I really just want to be able to put out amazing original records and really just like give them a life, and it not necessarily be dance music. I think it, like, it can be.
But what's the process though? How would you feel if like you did that and you're like, this is the fucking best thing I've done, this is gonna have such a life, and then like it doesn't live up to your expectations of what you wanted to do? Would you still like just go hard in that sort of direction of your career and artistically, or would you be like, I need to make a fucking banger?
Well, I think it's tough, isn't it? Because I don't know.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But that's that's the beauty of making music and art is like.
And I think if you don't try it and you don't give it a proper go, like a real, like let's look at Tisha, right? For example, like her DJ sets aren't her music. She doesn't play her music in her DJ sets.
I've never heard a DJ.
Very rarely. Like obviously I'm sure she does, but like her, like I've seen her DJ sets and she doesn't really play her own music that she releases because it's like very different. Like her music's down-tempo-y kind of cool electronica stuff. And her DJ sets.
I love her music though.
Yeah, her music's so great.
Good. So good.
But her DJ sets aren't her music. It's a bit weird that for me where like, I play all my own records. Like 90% of my set is my own music, whether it's released or unreleased. But for me, the challenge is like, you can still release really great music and it doesn't have to be like, there's so many more people out there in the world that listen to music on a daily basis that don't come to a club.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
that's so true.
Like how many, like your parents, your brothers and sisters, like they all fucking listen to music every single day and they don't turn up to our club to see us play.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
that would be so sick, man, where you can make records that you want and then it's not fully expected of you to then just to go and tour those records. That'd be cool because there's no, the pressure's kind of off. If you can still tour without the expectation of your biggest records being you playing them.
Yeah.
Man, that would be so sick as an artist and a DJ.
I also think is an amazing thing is what we have over anybody else is if we could do that, if we could release records that did that, and then in our DJ sets, we did a DJ edit.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. yahoofinance.com.
Like, we're so lucky that we can DJ. People like the whole live show, like doing a live show or having a band, it's so expensive. Like, right,
would you consider, if you started like went down the street, would you consider going to a live show as well?
Yeah, I'd do a live show 100%.
That'd be sick, man.
I just think
it makes touring like, because touring gets tough sometimes. I'm not going to moan about touring because it's the best thing ever.
Yeah,
like it's literally the best thing. It does get tough sometimes when you know you haven't slept for like a few weeks or whatever, and then you're just knackered. But then, if you could like just only tour a handful of times in one stint because you're doing a live show, so that would be fucking cool, man. That just take the excitement and nervousness up to another notch before each show.
Yeah, because I think realistically the only, like the DJ culture is you just tour every weekend and you don't take time off and you just keep going and keep going and keep going, which I love. It's like, that's what I fucking absolutely love. But I also love the idea of like having a tour period But I guess if you look at like the Rolling Stones, right? Look at like all of these huge bands. They
just not on the road every single weekend. Do it in blocks.
But they were back in the day. They were touring. Yeah. They were touring like 2 years in a row without a day off. I was listening to a Rogan podcast with, who was it? Who did? I can't remember who it was. Anyway, they were saying they literally did 500 days non-stop touring.
Jesus Christ.
500 days. Like, not going home.
No wonder they were all doing heroin, shooting cocaine.
Not a single day. And then you hear, like, Steve Aoki and, like, Skrillex back in the day doing, like, 250 shows a year.
I mean, for the money they get paid, I'd do 250 shows a year.
But would you, though? Would you need to?
It's not needing to at that point. It's sustaining a lifestyle.
Yeah.
So you get the first sort of like two weekends of a really, in terms of high fees, we're talking over 100 grand, right?
Yeah.
So you get the first 4 weeks, say the first month of touring, £500,000 in a bank.
Yeah.
But, you know, take your taxes off or whatever, you probably see a couple of hundred grand.
Yeah, let's say quarter.
And it's like, Then your house, you level up on your house, you get a nice car, then it's like, shit, I've got to pay for all this stuff. Like, I've got to sustain it. And it's like, just constantly. And I think that level of show and that pressure, you kind of get addicted to it as well.
Yeah.
Like, you can't then just, you know yourself, you did a massive run in America, right?
Yeah.
And you do 2-3 weeks and of like 4 shows a week. To then go home and stop for 2 weeks, I find it's the hardest thing ever. Mm. The come down from the highs of you're in this place, next hotel,
yeah,
next gig, amazing, it was sold out, and then you're at a festival, and then you're flying to this new country, and then you get home, and you're like, it's silent, it's just all of a sudden calmness in your life.
Yeah.
And you're just like, fuck, I can't explain it sometimes. It's still, I just explain it as like the calm still after complete chaos for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I struggle with, man. It takes me about a week to sort of like drag myself to normality.
Yeah, I agree with that. I want to question that. Is it the fact that you can't sit with yourself, or is it the fact that you're seeing your peers touring and you're not?
I mean, but sometimes it's out of choice.
No, I know that, but like, I still, for me, when I see a bunch of people touring, I'm like, fuck, I should be touring.
I don't know. I find it different. I don't look at it like that. Because when I see like my mates touring, say if like you posted an artwork tomorrow and it had like, and I'm not touring for the next 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Because my missus would punch my head in if it did. But I'm not touring for the next 4 weeks. Out of choice. But if, yeah, like you post an artwork tomorrow and was like, or even people I didn't know,
yeah,
I'd be like, fucking go on, yeah, like that's sick. Do you know what I mean? I love seeing people do well, even if I don't know them. But then you are right, there's a part of me that's like, ah,
that, yeah, this is, I love seeing people do well, but it's,
if they post up like a show that I've played and it was really good, I'm like, oh fuck, I could be going to New York to play Brooklyn Mirage now. I'm like, it's so sick. If it's like a new territory that I've never, like if it's, you know, a show in Brazil somewhere, I've done, yeah, Brazil only like three times, I'd be like, oh, well, nice one. But then if it's somewhere that I know that is ace,
yeah,
and it's a sick place to play, I'd be like, fuck,
yeah,
get me back on the road.
Totally.
But it is just the calm with myself as well. It's like the real quiet times at home. If like, I can't make music for like a week after being home. I mean, really? I get into like a, it takes me honestly about a week just to get over the jet lag and just the come down of touring.
Have you ever looked at trying to like look at that?
Yeah, sometimes, but I always get out of it though. Yeah. This is the thing. So it's like, it's just something that happens.
Yeah.
And after a week, I'm you're set. Dead. But yeah, it's just that come down, man, it's brutal sometimes.
Does it affect others around you?
No, I kind of hide it really well, which is not a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But I just, because if you come home, you've got to be a dad. Fly home from America and it's Sunday and you've got to be a dad. You land on Monday night, you've got to put the baby to bed.
Yeah.
He doesn't know or care that the fact that you feel like shit because you've just had this massive crash of dopamine and adrenaline has just gone through the floor after 2 weeks of like the highest high.
Totally.
You've got to go and put the baby to bed, you know what I mean?
I want to talk about sustainability. You kind of briefly brought it up, like with lifestyles as a DJ and earning money and living within your means. How do you manage that?
Mate, I am, if you ask like Melee, for example, I am Scrooge, man, with money. I swear, like, I don't.
He's the opposite. I had him on the podcast. He's like, I got to save money. Mate, he's like, I don't know how to save money.
Mate, we are polar opposites.
Really?
We always laugh about it, we're the complete opposite. So, we got up. I was like, mate, it's PRS day. And he's like, fuck, no way. Like, let's get the money in. And where did we go? He messaged me and he was like, I've just got my PRS money. I'm on my way to Flannels. And I'm going Tesco to buy nappies. And he's buying his £600 coat. And I'm there. I'm really tight with money. Like,
yeah.
Every money that I've gone has gone to savings. Like, I bought my house.
Yeah.
Like, I don't go and buy like expensive cars or watches or whatever. Because I did that when I first started touring. I got a really nice car and was like, shit, I've got to pay for this thing now monthly. Yeah. I just leased a brand new Audi straight off the showroom floor. And after a year, I was like, fuck, can I give this thing back?
Yeah,
and they're like, no, you've got another 12 months. I was like, Jesus Christ. Renting expensive houses.
Yeah.
And then spending. My outgoings were like insane. Just to live a certain lifestyle. Moved house like 4 times because I just wanted a better house every time. Just like, wow. I rent a new house, like detached houses.
Yeah.
I was like, this is fucking stupid. And then like literally a few years ago, I was like, from mom and dad, literally moved in with my missus and was like, we're going to move back to mom and dad's, save up for a year, buy a house.
Yeah.
Like, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do because I feel like it's impossible to save and then buy unless you're earning a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
So then we literally was home for like 7 months and then saved up and bought a house and got straight out. But it's just, I'm pretty tight with money. I don't spend money easily. And I'm always trying to find ways to save as well. If my accountant phones me up, he's like, oh, I'm always like, how can we save money? Like, save money.
Yeah.
Always. If I've got to pay a certain bill, you need a music lawyer in this territory. How come, can you not do it to my manager?
He's
like, fuck off now.
Yeah, I think.
But I that's just, that came from me spending insane amounts of money when I was first started touring. And then only up until like 2018, I was like, nah, this has got to stop. This, you're just constantly going to be renting houses and just spunking your money away and just, you're never going to have anything saved up.
Yeah.
And that's what I did when I was DJing around bars as well. I get, because it was always cash in hand. I'd get to the end of the week and it was like 3 gigs, did like £700 in a week. The next week before my first gig started, I'd have like £20.
Yeah.
I was just like, and I was living at home when I was like 19, 20, 21. And the next gig, I'd have like no money. And I was like, what the fuck? And it, like, I'd check, it was like two taxis a day, dinner out every single night. And I was like, ah, oh, there's the problem. Whereas now I'm just like cooking every night, really go out to eat ever. I'm always looking for cheap flights.
You're so right. And I think, I think people from an outsider's point of view see the DJ world because it's all over social media. It's like you're earning millions of pounds and dollars and kind of you're living this extravagant lifestyle, which we live the best fucking lifestyle. But it all costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you've also got to pay everybody else as well that works for you. And then you got to pay taxes and then you're left with, from realistically, like, not much of your fee. And I think it's very easy to kind of get caught up in that social media world where you're showing off everything you've kind of can buy. And it cringes me out personally. I'm not a huge fan of it and I understand why it happens. But I think it's so important as an artist to be able to... This is a career, so it's like, treat it like a career and treat it like you're working a 9-to-5 and save your money and be sensible with your money and not live an extravagant lifestyle. And it's like what you were saying with like the big guys earning hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's like, don't live way below your means.
I genuinely don't believe that they could afford to stop for a few months, because then you've got, if they are buying expensive houses or what, I mean, look, I'd do the same if I had that level of money as well. Get that size house. I'd do the, because you just have that much money in the bank. You think it's going to be there, but then you've got to chase the next show. I think that's the next gig.
That's the thing that I don't know if I would personally. Like, don't get me wrong, if I was earning like that much money,
you got 6 million quid in your bank, you not telling me you'd move into some sick gaff?
I would build a cool place in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, you wouldn't move in, you'd build it.
Yeah. But like, I think I'd also have no desire to live an extravagant lifestyle. The only things in my life that are expensive is food, really.
Hey.
Hey, buddy.
Can you see him?
I can see it's fluffy.
You okay? Go on, go to mummy. He wants to get on the podcast.
He does. I think when you're a multimillionaire, I think it's different, if you know what I mean, if you got that much money in your bank. But also it's like, how much else are you having to pay for? Like these big shows that they're putting on, like let's say for instance Fish put in 28,000 tickets in Sydney, that costs a lot of money to put on. There's a lot of people behind that take a lot of money out of that as well. Like you just in that, yes, he's making a shit ton of money, but to sustain that living, you also have to spend a lot of money in your career, not just...
Yeah, oh, you've got to invest in everything. This is another thing that people probably don't realise. It's like, when I took my management on, they were like, the first time I ever spoke to them, I think it was in 2014, I got management. And they were like, well, we take 20% of your money. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, what? You take 20% of my money? And then it was like, so your agent takes 10%, and manager takes 20%. So that's 30%. As I go, it's not cash in hand anymore. You're doing, so it's invoices. So you've got to pay full whack of tax on it as well.
Yeah.
But then I was like, shit. So that's basically 50% of all my fees gone.
Mm-hmm.
So then £700,000 gigs, now 500, and then it's your travel, which a lot of times...
£700,000? You're getting £700,000 a show?
£700,000 a show. I'm buying that big house now.
Jeez, coming around yours for dinner.
And then you're left at the end of the, like, say you got one show that week. After your expenses of traveling, this is when I was, you know, first got started in 2013, 14. Come at the end of the week with £300-400 quid.
Yeah.
Because you paid for travel as well, which is still Liverpool.
In the UK is Liverpool.
Kind of not really.
Not anymore, now. You
couldn't live off that now. And this is when I was back in my parents' house before we moved out in 2016. And I was like, shit, I've got to... And it's chasing the fees, chasing the gigs, expectation of releases. And it's one big melting pot of like, you're trying to find the next way to step your career up to the next level to then move to like 1,500 quid. Because I always sort of like, you start off at 500 quid, then you move to like 700 to a grand, and then you're on 1,500. And then the gap between 1,500 and 3 was super hard to like step. And then it goes to 3, and then from 3 it goes to like 7.
Yeah.
And then and then just moves from there then. And once you're at like that level of fee, you can just, you know, you know people yourself at that level, that you can just write your own, you can just ask for whatever you want then. Mm. But I always saw it in stages, and it was just kind of like the next stage to get to that, so I can invest more in social media, and I can invest more in, because I had a social media team that was paying like, how much was it? It was like £1,000 a month.
Really?
In 2015, when it wasn't even necessarily needed to that level, just to do like schedule posts for me, and I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
I could be doing this, and I just started doing it myself. And then now I'm like, shit, I should have kept them on, because social media now is everything.
Yeah.
Whereas in 2014, it wasn't. So it's kind of like spending money unnecessarily back in the day. And you just learn. You learn on the job, and you learn moving forward. You can't, I don't really see the choices of mistakes anymore. It's just kind of like learning curves. And like, you've done this before, this didn't work, so then don't do that again.
Yeah. I think also cash flow is so important as a touring DJ, because you're buying your flights 3 months in advance for a show, and you're paying expenses out, especially if you're in America or you're on landed deals. Europe's a little bit different because they do different deals where it's plus plus plus. Yeah. So like a lot of the time they're paying for your travel, but I think like
which because the trains are usually under 100 quid wherever you're going around the UK.
But like
America though, you pay for your own flights.
Everything's landed. So
same for Australia. So I played Australia in the end. I think it was the end of September, start of October. And I booked my flights 4 weeks before then. The flights are about $6,000. I've not been paid to me gigs yet.
Yeah.
So it's like just $6,000 in a hole for my flights.
And that's the thing that I'm saying is that like you have to have cash in the bank at all time. There has to be like a pool of money. So
yeah, it's a safety net. You can just kind of like, so a lot of DJs are using Amex to book the flights now, just because you're paying out your credit card and you pay it back the next month, where you'd hopefully will have been paid by then.
Which
I'm going to start doing as well.
When I moved to America, credit cards was like, growing up in England, credit cards isn't a thing at all.
I've never had one.
Yeah, but the minute I moved to America, I realized that your life is judged on, you like, financial life is judged on credit. So if you don't have a credit card, you can't get a mobile phone contract. You can't get a mortgage. You can't.
It's encouraged to get credit cards. To pay them off.
Yeah, to build a credit score. So then it's easier to then get a mortgage. It's easier to go lease a car.
So if you've never had a credit card, your credit rating will be low.
You don't have a credit score.
What the fuck?
Yeah, it's same in the UK. So
I've never had a credit card though.
Yeah. Your credit score will be less than what it would be if you had a credit card. But the different thing in the UK is you don't need.
You can still buy shit.
you can have a phone contract in the UK without having like a credit score, because you do have a credit score, but like, because you're not in any debts or anything. Like, you can still get a mortgage in the UK if you don't have a credit card, because your credit score is still based on your bank. Where in America, it's very different. Like the way.
Are you back in America now?
Yeah, I'm in Detroit.
Ah, I thought you'd moved back home. Last time I spoke to you, you said you'd moved home.
Yeah,
I saw you in New York. Was it Electric Zoo?
Yeah, I was in the UK then.
Okay.
So when I'm touring America, I usually base myself in Detroit. But this summer has been like 1 weekend in Europe, 1 weekend in America, 1 weekend somewhere else. So it's just like, I've not really been in Detroit that much.
Yeah. Have you kept your place there?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. That's sick to have a base over there.
It's so hand. Man, this is, again, it goes back to what we were talking about. Is like, I was living in LA initially, didn't really like LA, so I moved. I was then moved to New York.
Like the first place you moved to? Yeah. You straight to LA?
Yeah.
Go on, lad. Straight in.
Because I thought, like, I didn't know. Like, I obviously...
LA is, in terms of the music industry, when you first start touring America, you think, like, LA. Music industry is in LA,
And, like, I'd been to America a bunch, and I toured America a couple times, but that was, like, my first real big tour in, like, 2005, I think it was.
Wow.
No, 2015, not 2005.
Because did you start touring properly in America
first? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Because you did the Dirty Bird stuff, right?
Yeah, I did it backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did it like backwards to what everyone else in the UK did. Like, I still can't get booked in the UK in a lot of places.
I don't feel like our sounds are necessarily the popular sort of like the regional bangers that we were talking about, like the Nottinghams, the Bristols, those shows, like. I just wouldn't connect with the sort of like uni students from those local areas. I agree with the promoters. There's no point booking me for them because, you know, it's my sound isn't necessarily
that
popular there. Whereas in America at the minute, it's just completely blowing up for me over there. It's like every other booking is an American booking, if not more now. So
it's great.
I think next year is going to be heavily focused on getting it backwards and forwards to America.
But that's going back to that thing. It was like I was in LA and then moved to New York. I love New York. New York's my favorite place in the world.
New York's the best.
It's the fucking best. Yeah. But I was at the point where I needed a place full time, and
you ain't paying New York prices.
Exactly. And that's it. It's like, I want a level of life. Like, I like a level of like niceties, right? And like, I have a level where I'm not going to live in absolute squalor to just live in a city. And do I want to spend $4,000 a month on rent in New York to have like a 2-bedroom apartment so I can have my studio in my apartment with me? Or do I want to move somewhere way more affordable where I can buy a house and have...
Have you got a studio in your house?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
This is, yeah, you're in my studio now.
Nice.
So it's like, that was another thing. It's like, realistically, how can I be so as efficient as possible so that when I'm touring in America, I don't have to pay hotels during the week. I then have a place where I can work. And
were you always quite like savvy with money, or did you ever go through a period of like, obviously the LA period?
No, because the LA period was like, I literally rented a room. I was paying,
oh really?
I was paying $1,200 a month renting a room. And only recently, like in the last few years, like, have I been earning reasonably good money touring?
Yeah, same.
So it, realistically for me, is like, I've never really like had so much expendable cash where I'm like, fuck it. Yeah. Occasionally I might buy some nice sneakers, if you know what I mean. I might buy some nice trainers and like do that. But
you ever find it like, if you released like a big like record, like your family are like, oh, so you must have loads of money now. Like, say if like you get a record that does well, everyone thinks you earn a heap ton of money off like releasing music.
It's really weird because like I'm like really close to my family, and we like my parents know so much about my career. It's like they know fees and everything, and they understand all. So like, no, they know that it's like you're not earning money realistically in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, it's your mates, definitely. Like, your mates will hear you on Radio 1 and think you're a fucking millionaire.
Yeah. I remember when the remix for Josh like was going like insane. I think who played it? Like, I think Nick Grimshaw played it on In the Morning.
Yeah.
Just once. And that's when mum and dad were like, that's you. And I was like, yeah, made it in your loft. And then you were like, fuck. So my dad was like, so you must be minted now. I was like, dad, I didn't make a penny from that record.
Yeah.
Not a single penny. And he's just like, no way. He's like, so you've got to speak to get some money out of it. I was like, that's not how it works.
Are we sending the heavies round?
I just literally signed a contract to do a remix that was zero fee on it and zero percentages.
Oh, really?
Kills me to this day, man.
What label was that?
It was on MTA. So basically, there was two remixes, wasn't there? So So the first remix came out on MTA.
Yeah.
Well, the very first remix I did, the label knocked it back, which was the one that got really popular.
Yeah.
And I played it to Pleasurecraft.
Yeah.
And he was like, we'll release that on my label. And we'll do it as like, because you can't just do the Bontemps remix on MTA.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Bontemps remix on the label is like, we'll do a Bontemps versus Pleasurecraft edit.
Yeah.
And that second one is the one that came out on Pleasurecraft label that did really well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't sign anything for that either. Yeah. I know.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. That was tough.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It happens a lot.
I had no management, nothing. Yeah. So it was kind of like, it was messed up because then that edit got taken down off all platforms. Mm. It did really well. And then MTA took it. I don't know who took it down. It was licensed by Sony for something. And then it got really messy because it was like, no one knew
who owned
it. So I signed a contract to do the remix for Josh on MTA.
Yeah.
Which was just a standard sort of like heads of agreement. There was nothing.
Yeah.
It was one page. It just sounded the remix. I didn't think it was going to do anything. I was like, didn't ask for any money. First ever track. I was like, it's good to be on the label. And then obviously did that first one that Pleasure Craft had heard, and he was like, mate, this is massive.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, MTA rejected that. And he was like, let's release it on my label. And then he got in touch with MTA and then subleased my remix.
Yeah.
I don't know how it really worked.
Yeah, he and wouldn't license your remix.
Change it to an, but then we did the edit, which got really, the edit was the original remix that got knocked back by MTA. We just did a little Skype chat and did change the arrangement and then released it on his label. I didn't sign anything for that either or ask for a fee. I'm the second highest seller on Beatport.
You just think they'd fucking give you some money.
That's not what it is.
It's
asking someone for money though, isn't it? It's like, do you know what I mean? It's just human nature. Someone comes up to you and says, can I have some money? Even though initially I did sign a contract for MTA, which probably covered the entirety of what happens going forward. I don't know. But something happened where everything got taken down. I didn't have a representation. I had no management, nothing. Yeah. So that remix was smashing it on Beatport. So the edit of the remix, which was both me as well. So it wasn't like they were trying to get me to sign it so they could just then take all the cash. It was kind of like they wanted to take it back because I don't know what had happened.
So
it kind of just got pulled. I've never seen it before in terms of like how messy the situation was. I wasn't privy to any conversation, just little bits of it, of like, right, so you need to sign this. I was like, cool. I was like, first ever remix. I was like, I'd probably do it again now if I was first starting out.
Because well, this is the thing, and this is why this podcast is great for it, because there's going to be a fuck ton of kids that probably hear this and are like, don't fuck, like, it's just stealing.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, if it wasn't for that, I don't think I'd be sat here now doing this.
But the record, you know what I mean? The record was doing well before you signed the contract.
True.
Like, good music does well.
Yeah.
And I think I understand what you're saying, that you're like, that record was the, like, that record has allowed you to do everything else.
Yeah, sure. Which,
great. Yeah, it has. But somebody's also made a fuck ton of money. And I know I don't want to bring all this up because it's like, I'm sure you processed it and everything like that, but somebody else is making money out of it.
Someone else. Yeah, which, someone else.
Like,
I don't know who, like, I honestly couldn't tell you who or whether it's one of the majors or whatever, but
somebody has. And that is the joys of doing a remix, right? Like, you get a remix fee or like, and even now, like, for if, like, when I get asked to do remixes, I will push hard on the percentages and I'll push hard on on publishing now. Like
more so than actual fee for me. Yeah. I'll always push for percentages rather than get a DJ fee.
Yeah.
Sorry, not a DJ fee, a remix fee.
That's, yeah.
Because I'm not, especially now for me, that off chance, it might just go mental.
Yeah.
And then there's thousands and thousands and thousands.
I think push for publishing as well because realistically you're writing a whole new record.
Mm-hmm.
And
true,
and it's still you as an artist. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the thing that no one gets taught about when you're kind of coming up, and no one tells you about music law. Like, none of us fucking have a clue about it. Like,
I don't know what it was. It was like, I was shitting myself about signing this contract.
Yeah,
I've never
exactly, yeah,
really released any music before.
Yeah,
and it was doing so well. I was like, so if I don't sign this, it's going to get taken down off everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, I need to keep this alive because it was peak, like, going crazy. And it got taken down anyway.
Even my first, like, management contract, I got a music lawyer to look at it and I still didn't have a fucking clue what I was signing and then regretted it after I signed it.
Like, you just trust in the music lawyer then at that point.
Exactly. And it's like, I don't know this fucking dude. Like, it could be anybody. And, like,
I've never signed a management contract.
No.
I don't think I ever will either.
I won't just ever because, again.
No, because you're working with each other. Like, that's just the way it should be. It's sort of like a gentleman's agreement. Like, you work together, you commit to each other, and if it doesn't work out, you part ways and you have to pay someone for the next year or two afterwards.
Totally agree. And I think
that's kind of what happened to you. Did you sign it?
Yeah, I signed it, and then I tried to leave, and he tried to sue me for £250,000, and I'm like. Well, I'm not actually supposed to talk about this.
I wasn't meant to talk about the thing as well, but here we are.
Here we are. It's gone now. We're all friends. I didn't pay him 200. I was like, mate, if I can afford £250,000, I would not be suing you. I would not be leaving you. Like, we'd be successful and we wouldn't be leaving. Like, let's do the maths here. Like, you know how much money I earn. Like, yes, I'll pay you. And then, yeah, cut long story short, I got out of it. But ended up paying him money. But it was...
Yeah. It gets messy. Like, one thing I would say, if people are sort of starting out, it's just always... Again, though, I'd say read contracts and be wary. But, like, what does that mean? If I was put in the same position starting out again, I'd do the same thing over again. I genuinely feel like I would. Just out of anxiety that it wasn't going to keep going if I didn't.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's just a learning curve. I wouldn't do it now, but if I was starting out again, I'd probably do this the exact same way. Yeah. I wouldn't change a thing. I'd be sat 10 years on fuming.
Yeah, I agree, because I also think, like, even now, like, I still there's so much I don't know about, and I still have to do so much research, and like, I write music for other people, and like, then I get the deals through and they're talking about PPD and stuff like that, and I'm like, I need to fucking learn so much, and like, they're talking about certain deals and I'm like, I Google so much now, and then I just call friends that are in higher places that know more about it than me. And I think, and I call like multiple people, and then I get like three different answers, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, no. And then I'm realized like, no one actually really fucking knows what they're doing here. And it's just winging it. And realistically, it's the big labels are making the money out of the people that are creating all the great music.
Yeah, mate, it's true. Like, again, don't matter what happened to me, MTA was owned by a major then as well. I've got under no impression that it wasn't the major labels that pull the strings for every decision that happens.
Of course.
And that ain't going to change.
No, it's not.
Until, like, releasing music, you set up on your own label and releasing music that way. But in terms of the bigger stuff, the majors just call the shots.
Yeah.
And if you're just starting out like I was and put in a position where you had to sign something, I just did. And I probably would again.
Yeah.
Just out of pressure. Like I said, pressure, it's kind of fucked up, but. Is it ever going to change? Will it ever change?
No. There's always going
to
be...
Well, it's a world I'm happy to live in, unfortunately.
That's the thing. It's sad that it is like that. But realistically, we can complain about it all we want, or we can just get on and write as best music as possible and keep going.
That's it. Yeah, man. That's all we do.
Like, realistically, the majors, especially in our world, like, the majors sign a dance record, not really because it's going to necessarily do well as well. Like, they have fucking Adele. Like, they don't need us, if you know what I mean.
No.
They're signing culture. That's the reason why I feel like they're signing dance records is because of the culture behind it. It makes the label look cooler. It gives them different culture.
And I look at a remix, we can complain about majors, but a remix fee from a major label is always nice as well.
It's always nice. It's always nice.
Always nice.
And that they lose out so much money on things like that because they never recoup these remixes. A lot of these remixes, especially now with Spotify, where Spotify doesn't give a fuck about remixes. Apple don't give a fuck about remixes. And that's a lie, actually. Apple does give a fuck about remixes. But like, you put a remix out on Spotify and it's like the likelihood of it doing well is very, very, very low.
Yeah, facts.
So it's like, these labels aren't really making that much money off the fees that they're buying into culture. They're buying your name. That's what they're paying for.
True. So they always will.
Yeah,
I think that's they always will. They always will, and they always do. But again, I'll take the fee and do the remix.
Yeah, like, yeah, man.
As you probably have many times before as well.
Yeah, couple I've regretted over the years, but is what it is.
Yeah, there's always a few that you're like, oh, fuck.
I did like two during COVID.
Hey, but mate, you've got to earn some money. This is again going back to treating it like as a job, as a 9-to-5. It's like, how else would we have earned any money in COVID?
Yeah,
I did a couple of remixes as well in COVID that I didn't even shout about or push the release because I was like, I've got to get some fucking money in here.
Mm. Yeah, that's you had to. You had to turn the lights on, keep the lights on at the end of the day.
Because I wasn't getting like the monthly payment from the government or anything. I didn't get it. I didn't get a drop.
No.
Because if you set up as like a company, if you're a director of your own company, you don't get, even though you're an employee of your own company, but you're the director as well.
Unless you're a limited company.
Yeah. I am.
Yeah.
I didn't get anything.
Yeah, you could have got a loan.
The bounce back loan.
Yeah.
I got the bounce back loan.
Yeah.
I think everyone did, because it was just kind of like 0.001% repayments, and I was basically free money to then pay back. Yeah.
Take it on, or in solve your company afterwards.
The people that did that, I was just like, that's insane. You got some balls to be able to do that.
It's the whole point of having a limited company, and the government's trying to tell you to have a limited company because then you take nothing on personally. If the government's giving you no money, giving you free money, and then giving you the opportunity to like insolve your company, then fucking go for it. Like,
I wonder what you did.
Yeah. Going through it right now. It's like, well, I think also the thing is before COVID, I had a business in the UK. Like, I had financial income coming in the UK. After COVID, all my touring moved to Europe and America. So it's like, there's no money coming in. What can you do? Like, in that That's UK true. Company. So it's like, for me, I have a company in America.
Nice. Is that where you set up now, in America?
I've been set up in America. I what was that?
It's just lunatic. Oh, yeah.
Hey.
Oh, hi.
Hi, buddy.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Go back to mommy.
Yeah.
Wait there 2 seconds. Come here. What's the matter?
This is the first time the podcast has been taken over by a child, and I love it.
I'll take the laptop upstairs if you want.
We can wrap up soon, dude.
That's all good.
But yeah, I think I moved everything into America pretty much when I first started touring in America. It was like the first thing I did was like work out how to get this taxing in America sorted, because it's a nightmare, as I'm sure you're
I'm trying to go through a tax return in America at the minute, because with all the tax, it's just fucking insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah, and then you get your percentage back from your UK tax to up to 19%, and then you've got to do a tax return for the rest of it that's in America, which I didn't realize up until you can only do. I thought you could take it back from when you first started coming to America. I didn't know this.
Yeah,
and then you pay your management fees and stuff. Like, the withholding tax isn't taken off.
Yeah.
So then I pay management fees from 2017, 18, without what withholding tax taken off, and I can't even claim that back anymore. Yeah. I'm just like, fuck. So you're losing extra money there.
I think you can go back to 2019.
That's it, 2019. Yeah. So at the minute we're doing, which was just before fucking COVID. So I only did two tours in 2019, just start of 2020. And then August 2021, I got over there. I got one of those, what are they called? You get like a pardon from the UK to go over. Do you remember when we first came out and you had to apply to go to America?
Yeah, what was that called?
And they turned down a bunch of people. Yeah. And then my manager called me and was like, mate, you got yours through.
Get the fuck out.
I got
out
on a
there.
Flight.
Yeah.
It was a, got an A380, mate, and there was 16 people on there.
Wow.
It was insane. I got to Heathrow and they were like they couldn't understand why I was getting on a plane. It was like no one had been told why people were traveling.
Yeah.
And they were like, what are you doing? And I was like, I've got this letter that says I'm allowed to travel to America to work. I've got a visa. And they were like, they were so confused because I didn't have a suit on or I ended up in trackies on. And they were just like, what? They had called four different people and they were just kind of like, well, all his papers and everything's in check. I got there and God bless Florida because they just did loads of shows in Florida because they were just open.
Florida and Texas.
Yeah, literally.
Florida and Texas kept DJs alive through that period.
Massively. So this was August 2021.
Yeah.
And then New York, the week before, just been passed. Yeah. I did Elro New York, and it was the first time anyone had done like over 1,000 caps somewhere or something like that. And I played there, and it was like,
did I do that with insane. You?
Was it August 2021?
We were on the same lineup.
Yeah, I did. Josh played as well.
I'm pretty sure.
Me and Josh played back to back. I think you were.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think I saw you
there. Desert Heart on the inside.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was so good.
It's so good. And then just that flight over was weird, man. It was fully staffed. So like, and those A380s, it's like 20 staff.
Yeah.
So everyone had an air steward to themselves.
Wow.
And it was insane. I was just like, everyone just started talking to each other because I think they just sort of like moved everyone to club, which is business class.
Oh, really?
So everyone just sort of like could just sit where they wanted. It was an empty
wild. That's so wild, man.
And everyone just started chatting to each other and just like, what are you doing here? How are you allowed to come here?
Oh, insane, man. We're so lucky. Like,
now we are.
Now we are, yeah, I guess. I think the thing
is... What have you got coming up?
Just a bunch of touring. Yeah. I go back to the UK. Well, by the time this comes out, I would have gone back to the UK, going away with my family. And then going to Senate Parks with the family and then back to New York. I'm going... Took a weekend off. One of my mates getting married in New York. And then just touring.
Center Parks for the vibes.
Yeah, mate. It's always fun.
Love it.
Always fun. What about you? You got a baby coming.
Yeah. And then I've not actually got any releases planned. I'm doing some... I've got like a bunch of collabs on the go at the minute and just like releases, but there's nothing set in stone for next year.
Yeah.
But Warehouse Project ended the month.
Is that New Year's Eve?
I'm doing 30th.
Nice.
And then I'm doing 338 in London on New Year's Day. And then straight to America. And then just kind of, I've got so many records finished that I'm just trying to figure out what I'm doing.
Put in the bank.
Going to do something with Diplo as well. We're kind of backwards and forwards working with something.
Amazing.
So yeah, man, hopefully next year you'll be seeing a lot more of me in America.
Yeah, man, well, I'll be here.
I love it out there, man. I love it out there.
It's funny, isn't it? Like how everybody that tours in America wants to be touring in Europe. Everyone that's touring in Europe wants to be touring in America.
And you've probably seen it because you were touring in America as a UK artist before most in terms of like regularly to the point where you moved out there.
Yeah.
And then you've probably seen all these UK acts that were like, I just want to play in the UK to then be like, right, fuck, America's popping up. Because it really is like you could tour 3-4 times a week in America now. Mm-hmm. I feel like I could tour 3 times a week in America without a doubt. And the shows are all so good.
I remember 2018, I did 112 shows in a year and 85 of them were in America.
That's nuts.
I know, right?
Because you forget. I mean, obviously you don't forget because it's fucking massive, but the size of America.
I wouldn't advise doing that. It's not a good thing for your career when you're doing that because it's...
Is there like regional bangers that we do in the UK, but in America?
Yeah. Like,
is it? What's like the maddest place you've been to?
There's some fucking weird places out here, man. I'm playing Indianapolis on Friday.
Whoa.
I bet you're like, what? Where the fuck is it? I don't even know where Indianapolis is. It's like 2 hours from me in Detroit, but I don't even know where Indianapolis is. Like,
I always think of like Kentucky and places like that. Yeah. Have you done like gigs there?
I did Alabama once.
Wow, what was
but
that, like?
That was like when I was 20 and it was awful. Like nobody turned up.
I always think like that. Like, what would the difference be in terms of like America and the UK in terms of those Reggie Banger shows? And what would it be like in America?
There's a lot. I think it's slowly growing. Like for me, like Texas, when I first started touring Texas, there was nothing in Texas. Now Dallas is amazing.
Austin, Dallas is so good.
Austin is amazing.
Have you done it? It'll Do in Dallas?
Yeah, I played there a few weeks ago. So good.
So good.
Yeah.
Did you do Open to Close? Have you done an Open to Close yet?
Yeah, in 2020, I did Open to Close there.
Can I ask, is that same guy that turns up there, he's kind of like, he wears like, best way to describe it is like Texas cowboy type stuff. And he's like, they say he's the first person there every week. He comes for like 2 hours, just drinks a Coke by himself and just dances.
I can't remember. I cannot remember.
I'll never forget this guy because he just stood there, had a Coke, and he was just dancing with a cowboy hat. And he just, this lad must have been like 22, 23. But they're like, he's there every week. And I was like, what a legend. And as I was leaving, I was just like, mate, you are a king. And he's just like, thanks for the music. I was like, but we need them people, man.
Yeah, we do.
Especially open to closes, right? Like,
yeah,
people aren't coming in for the first hour or so. You need those diehards at the front.
Open to closes are so much fun, though, aren't they?
I love them. So good. I love them. But then I'm kind of like, unless people aren't coming in off the bat, and if you don't know it's sold out already, or like you haven't sold it out, you're like, fuck, how many people are actually going to come?
Yeah, but I think that's
playing the first 2 hours like
empty.
Yeah, warming up, thinking, please come soon.
Club culture is different as well now. It's like, especially in America, you have like 2 hours. Like, headline culture is such a big thing here, so it's not really about the whole like the whole night. It's about go get your drinks like pre-game and then go turn up for the headliner. So like,
yeah,
to change that culture and to change the like I'm playing all night long, like it's hard to do. I did a whole tour of Open to Close. I did like 25 dates of Open to Close in America, which was an amazing experience. And in certain markets they really got it, and in certain markets you're like, why am I doing this? It's like, it's just pointless.
But that's what happens when you do an open to close tour. You've got to like take the rough with the smooth. Yeah, it's fun because they're not all going to be the same,
and also you get to just play music that you don't get to play. Like, I love opening sets. I love playing opening sets, especially like when was the last time you truly get to open a set? Like, you don't.
Talking about opening, so around the time of like that Remus came out, me and Josh did the we open up for Chic and Nile Rodgers around the UK. We did the UK tour with them. Mate, the first few shows people did not want to listen to our music. Because they were sold out shows, so people would fill into the venue and then we'd start. So then I think we played the Roundhouse in London twice. The Friday and the Saturday. We did the whole UK tour because now was like, I want quality house music. And then my manager sent him over all our stuff that we'd done. And he was like,
exactly what I want for the tour.
Yeah.
The speakers have just switched.
Yeah, you just switched.
So we did, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
So we did the Roundhouse, and honestly, mate. Strictly like, huh?
I lost you then. Carry on.
So we're playing strictly house music?
Yeah.
Strictly. And it was just people just staring at us for the entire 2 hours, mate, to the point where we left the first two shows in London. We had to go to Birmingham, and that was the next show. And like, we were driving the car, it was me, Josh, and my missus, and we were like, we've got to cancel the rest of this tour. Like, we can't do this. We're like, we can't do it. And my missus was like, what? Get your head in the game, switch it up. Because we were like, no, he wants house music.
Yeah.
So we kind of like just like turned it around. And every show we were getting more used to, like, no one is there to see you just open up. We're talking about open up and playing like stuff you'd never get to play. Mm. It was like, play it, lean into the disco a bit more, keep it house music, but lean into disco a bit more, explore new records that you wouldn't necessarily play.
Yeah.
And then by the time we got to Glasgow, we were like, we fucking nailed this. Like, we did like six shows, and then we got to Glasgow, and it was like
the best thing ever.
The best, mate. And you know, it's like in Scotland, we played like a few old classics, and then they just knew old like house records as well. Mm. So we were like, oh, thank God. Finish on a high. We like played Glasgow, went to the after party, like with everyone. And then we left thinking, like, without a weird taste in your mouth, do you know what I mean? It was like the last show was, we nailed it hard. And we were like, the first two shows, man, it was like, what have we got ourselves into? But then we played Manchester. And there was a group at the front that were going absolutely nuts. And they kept holding their phones up. And I was like, and then Niall came out, and he'd been tweeting him saying that the opening act is they're amazing. What are the guys' names? Because we didn't. it's fucking funny this. So the first two shows we had our name, Josh Butler and Bontan, on the thing, and they were like, from now on, get that taken down. Like, we don't want people to see on. Because no one wanted to listen to us. And we got to Manchester and like people were tweeting Niall going, what's the opening act? Like, they're playing really well. He came out because he'd always come out and like take us from behind the deck. So everyone would go nuts when he walks out. Yeah. And then we'd walk to the front and like say thanks to everyone and then leave. And then he kept going to me, you guys are fucking sick. Everyone keeps tweeting me saying how sick the warm-up act guys are. And he was tweeting everyone back like with our ads at Twitter. And that's I was like, so this good. Is like 5% of the room are dancing, the rest are just staring at us. And he's like, you guys are amazing. I was like, yes, let's go.
Oh, mate, that's an absolute win.
Yeah, fuck. It was
bizarre. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, just to see that level of sort of like production and that side of like performing in a way.
Yeah.
It sort of like sets you up for playing like big festivals because these were arenas. Like these were sold out arenas like up and down like the UK. But then when you go and play like Splash House or somewhere like a big stage or like Park Life on a plate, there was like 10,000 people there. I was like, right, don't stress because you've done the hardest one, whereas you're playing house music in a sold out arena and no one wanted to listen to house music.
So a bunch of old people that have never heard house music.
And they were just like, I just thought to myself, like, you've done the hardest one that you can do.
Yeah.
Like, anything else out from here is going to be a breeze. And you got through that fine and you didn't get...
You didn't die. You didn't die.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a strange, strange experience, man. Fun, though. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet.
I don't know, just hands down the nicest person ever as well.
Yeah, I've never met him, but he always seems super nice.
So sound.
Yeah.
He'd always come early to the shows, like meet people and stuff. And that's awesome. He'd always be, proper, proper good guy, man.
You just don't, like, especially... There's no excuse to be a shitty person. There's zero excuse. No. And when you're at that level of in your career and in life, like, you've seen everything. You've seen people come. You've seen people go. You've done everything in the world. Like, you must have learned so much wise ways. And to then come out to be a dickhead, it's just not worth it. Like, you just... just failure in life, right? It's just not worth it.
No, well, I hear you, man.
Mate, we've just done an hour and 50 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
shit.
Could keep going, but I've got another podcast in half an hour.
Are we going to get told off for 30% of stuff I've said on this?
It's fine, don't worry. Doesn't matter.
It's the truth.
Thank you so much for coming on, man. I've been wanting to do this for a while, and it's just great that I hit you up and you could do it so quickly. Yeah, so man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll probably see you on the road sometime over the next sort of like 6 months. We always bump into each other.
Definitely, man. Have a great Christmas. Hope the whole baby thing goes well. Let us know how it goes. How can people follow you on social media and all of that?
Just at Bontan Beats, Instagram, at Bontan UK, Facebook, Twitter. Yeah, that's it.
Sick. Mate, thank you so much. Keep safe and I will see you soon.
Love you.
Peace. Love you, dude. Bye.
See ya.
And that is a wrap. Big love to you, Bontan, for coming on. Loved it. Please hit subscribe. Please review us and keep safe. And I'll see you next time.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you're ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.